Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and we'll welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. This week, our feature text is Luke 2, verse 14, where the angel said, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace among those whom he favors." This week's title is A Revolution in a Manger. We're looking at part 3 of part 4, and we're looking especially at the aspect of this revolution that deals with peace on earth. This phrase, peace on whom he favors, that was the promise that Rome was making to the people. You can find this in part 1. These were the words that, once again, Luke places in the mouth of the angelic host in Luke 2. And peace, remember, was that the kind of peace that the angels were announcing was not through the militaristic violence of Rome, but on the other hand, it was peace through the other-centered, enemy-embracing, self-sacrificial, enemy-forgiving, humble, servant love of a new kind of king that they called King Jesus. The prophecy had been given in Isaiah, and it would be well for us to take a look at that this week. This is Isaiah 2:2-4. It says, "In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths.' For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations. He shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." This is why the baby lying in a manger had come. This was Jesus' dream, his pearl of great price. It was the dream for which he gave up everything, and he asks us to do the same. It's the restoration of his reign, the reign of Christ. It's his kingdom, the kingdom on earth once again as it is in heaven. You can find this in Matthew 13:45-46, and in Matthew 6:10. And what I want you to notice this week, in particular, is that the nations. What was it that the nations would actually learn from this new king? It says that they would beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. A few chapters later, Isaiah refers to this king again in a passage that is quoted over and over again this time of year during the Christmas season. It says, "For a child has been born for us, a son given to us, authority." And remember Luke 4:5-6, the devil in that passage had said that all authority in heaven and or on earth, all the kingdoms, had been given to him. In Matthew 28:18-19, Jesus said after his death and resurrection that now all authority had been given to him, both on heaven and on earth. And this passage here in Isaiah is referring to that. It says, "For a child has been born to us, a son is given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." And that's Isaiah 9:6. Yet what's missed so often, I think, is the very next phrase, Isaiah 9:7, where it says, "His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace." And what Isaiah is telling us is that this little baby lying in a manger, in a very real sense, is not just, you know, your regular run-of-the-mill average baby. This baby is an incarnate revolution that's of divine origin, and which would continue to grow until eternal peace would once again reign on earth. You can find that in Luke 2:14 and in Matthew 6:10 again. And how did this revelation begin? And this is really the key. Not only were the angels of Luke's story proclaiming another king other than Caesar, and not only were they proclaiming peace through something other than the Pax Romana, they were pointing to a helpless baby wrapped in strips of cloth and lying in a manger as the means through which all of this would be accomplished. And with keen perception, Dorothy Soleil looks into the manger of Bethlehem and has this to say. I want to share this with you this week. She says, "In Jesus Christ, God disarmed himself. God surrendered himself without protection and without arms to those who keep crying for more and more protection and arms. In Jesus Christ, God renounced violence. And of course, he did this unilaterally without waiting for us to lay down our weapons first." This baby lying in a manger had not come to bring peace through a sword. but peace through the way of the cross, through teaching us too how to love, how to forgive, how to embrace our enemies. And this is the testimony of the early church for the 300 years, those who were originally part of the Jesus Revolution, the Jesus Movement, who were following Jesus. I want to read just a little bit, just a sampling of their words this week. Origen writes, "We Christians no longer take up sword against nation, nor do we learn war anymore, for we have become children of peace." Tertullian writes, "And shall the son of peace take part in the battle when it does not become him even to sue at law? And shall he apply the chain, the prison, the torture, and the punishment, who's not even an avenger of his own wrongs?" Hippolytus writes, "Anyone who has the power of the sword, or who is a civil magistrate wearing the purple, should desist, or he should be rejected." Arnobius writes, "Rather, it is better to suffer wrong than to inflict it. We would rather shed our own blood than stain our hands and our consciences with that of another." Arnobius again writes, "It makes no difference whether you put a man to death by word, or rather by the sword, since it is the act of putting to death which is prohibited." Lactantius says, "When God forbids killing, he just doesn't ban murder, which is not permitted under the law even. He's also recommending us not to do certain things which are treated as lawful among men. Whether you kill a man with a sword or a word makes no difference, since it is the killing itself that is banned." And Lactantius again writes, "No exceptions at all are to be made to the rule that it is always wrong to kill a man for whom God has wished to be regarded as a sacrosanct creature." Tertullian writes, "In disarming Peter, Christ unbelted every soldier." And someone always raises the objection, but what about Jesus' words in Matthew's gospel? "I do not think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword." Now, at face value, and I think taken grossly out of context, this seems to be a direct contradiction to the angelic host's proclamation in Luke, as well as the prophecies that we've just seen from Isaiah. And just keep reading Jesus' words in Matthew, though, and you'll see exactly what he's saying. Here is the entire passage. This is Matthew 10:34-38. He says, "Do not think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, and daughter against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. One's foes will be members of one's own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me." What I want you to notice is in this passage, the man against his father, the man against his father is not the follower of Jesus. It's the father that's the follower of Jesus, and the man has turned against him for following him. It's the same with the daughter and her mother, the daughter-in-law, and the ones of the one's own household. What we have to distinguish is peace as the means versus peace as the end goal. I think we can all agree that Jesus came to bring peace as the ultimate end goal. And we all have the hope that Christ will one day bring an end to the violence that so riddles our world. But how would this baby lying in a manger accomplish this? That's the million-dollar question this week. This passage seems to indicate that the means whereby peace would be accomplished would not be so peaceful. Now, there's two ditches here that we have to remain out of with this passage. First, the first ditch is we have to not fall into saying, "See, Jesus said not peace but a sword," and then to rush into using the sword or violence to try and establish peace. This is not what Jesus is saying at all, in the least, and verse 38 proves it. But the other ditch, which Jesus is actually addressing in this passage, is to say that we are people of peace, and thereby we are never to be a source of conflict in the world, that we are always to simply go with the flow and not cause waves. We're to go about private piety and post-mortem bliss and personal holiness, and never provoke the systematic injustice that's proliferated by the way this world is presently structured. As a tangent, some interpret Romans 13 even this way. But you have to remember that Paul was writing Romans 13 from a Roman jail cell. Jesus taught neither using violence to accomplish peace, nor did he teach that passive non-resistance in the name of keeping the peace. That only allows evil to go unchallenged. What Jesus taught is actually non-violent non-cooperation in response to evil. What Jesus is addressing in Matthew 10 couldn't be more clear, in my opinion. He's not saying that his followers should take up a sword themselves. What Jesus is saying is that in response to those who would use the label of peace for a veil to hide their own cowardice, their own fear, or their desire to avoid conflict even. Jesus is telling those in very clear tones that following him and his revolution will produce a sword, not in the hands of his followers, but in the hands of those for whom this present structure that the world is structured in is stacked in their favor, and who see Jesus and his followers as a threat to those benefits. Now, look at it this way. How did Rome respond to the early Jesus revolution? Just look at it historically. According to Luke in Acts 7, the disciples were accused of turning the world upside down and acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor and saying that there's another king named Jesus. Now, this is Acts 17, 6 through 8. And what I want you to notice is that this was spoken from the perspective of a Roman, from the Roman paradigm. And it's true that the disciples were acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor. It's also true that they were proclaiming a different king other than Caesar, but they were not turning the world upside down. The world was already upside down. The disciples were working to restore, to heal, and to turn the world right side up again and enlarge the reign of Christ. From the Roman perspective, it looked like they were turning it upside down, but it was already in the wrong direction. They were putting it right side up. The way the world was structured in the days of Rome is pretty much the way the world is structured today. It favors a very few at the top at the expense of masses at the bottom. And it may help you to imagine a pyramid structure. What Jesus was proclaiming was that he had come to establish a kingdom that would be a blessing to the poor, but it would be a woe to those who were rich. And you can find this in Luke 6, 20 through 24. Jesus had come to turn the world right side up again, and it would be a blessing to those whom the present structure was opposing or oppressing, but it would be seen as a threat to those that this present system was rewarding or benefiting. And how would those who were being benefited by the systemic evil of this world, how would they respond to Jesus and his followers? Well, Jesus says it very clearly, I've come to set a man whom this present structure favors against his father, who has decided to follow Jesus and this radical revolution. A daughter whom this present structure favors against her mother, who has decided to follow Jesus and this radical revolution. A daughter-in-law, the same thing, whom this present structure favors against her mother-in-law, who has decided to follow Jesus and his radical revolution. And one's foes, those whom this present structure favors, who are threatened, will be members of one's own household who has decided to follow Jesus in this radical revolution. Whoever loves his father, Jesus said, or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. What Jesus is saying is at the end of the day, what you're going to have to do is take up the cross and follow me. And anyone, he says, that doesn't take up the cross isn't worthy of me. What Jesus really is saying is that the ultimate goal of peace is not going to be accomplished by living a life of no conflict and calling it being peaceable. The goal of peace will be accomplished through embracing a cross, both his and ours. Jesus's peace, yeah, is in a way, it's accomplished by a sword, but it's only in a way. It's not a sword wielded in the hands of those who are the peacemaker. It's the sword being wielded in the hands of those who are opposing Jesus as peacemakers. It'll be a sword in the hands of those who are threatened by the Jesus revolution, a sword that's being wielded against the peacemaker. And while the peacemaker responds in nonviolent, other-centered, enemy-embracing, forgiving love, it's this peace that moves and wins what Martin Luther King called a double victory, where you're winning not only a world change, you're not only accomplishing world change, but you're winning your enemies to it, seeing them as seeing them as victims of the systemic evil themselves. Remember, as we look at all of this, that peace brought through non-violent non-cooperation is non-violent, but it's non-cooperative too. Peace is accomplished by non-violent non-cooperation in three steps. The first, which doesn't appear to be very peaceful or agreeable, first Jesus calls us to provoke that which is out of harmony with his reign on earth, which is around us today. This was demonstrated in his cleansing of the temple. And second, the second step is those who are being benefited by that which is out of harmony with the reign of Christ here on earth, they're going to lift the sword against us for when we provoke the system. The sword is lifted against us because we're interpreted as a threat to their way of life. And this was demonstrated by Jesus' arrest by the temple police. And third, we're called to respond to those who lift the sword against us by embracing the cross. And this was demonstrated in Jesus' nonviolent, loving response of embracing and forgiving those who were crucifying him. You can find that in Luke 23:34. I want to wrap up this week with the words of a sermon. It's actually appropriate. It's a Christmas sermon given in 1967 by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which I believe is incredibly appropriate, and it's entitled Peace on Earth. And I want you to read it prayerfully this week. He says, I've seen too much hate to want to hate myself. I've seen hate on the faces of too many sheriffs, too many white citizens, counselors, and too many Klansmen of the South to want to hate myself. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear. Somehow we must be able to stand up before our most bitter opponents and say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws and abide by your unjust system, because nonviolent non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is the cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail, and we will still love you. Bomb our homes, threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour. Drag us out on some wayside road. Leave us half dead as you beat us, and we will still love you. Send your propaganda agents around the country and make it appear that we are not fit culturally and otherwise for integration, and we will still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. And we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. By the time of Constantine, the Jesus Revolution was growing so exponentially that it had become a significant threat even to Rome herself. Nero had tried to crush it and failed, and you have to remember the reason. The way that nonviolent non-cooperation works is that when the sword is raised against it, the sword or the cross causes it to propagate rather than be extinguished, and the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the proclamation of Christ's reign and the kingdom. Diocletian had tried to, just like Nero, to crush it and had failed. Constantine felt like he had to do something, and we have to look at what he actually did. With the skillful help of others, Constantine co-opted the Jesus Revolution from the inside out. If this had not happened, Jesus' followers would have still continued to have the sword lifted against them, and many would have continued to lose their lives, but eventually the Jesus kingdom would have been the last kingdom standing. And this was what Constantine foresaw and feared, that really it would mean the end of Rome. And the kingdoms of this world would have become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ had Constantine not been successful. And history has gone a different direction now for a time, but the promise of Isaiah 2 still remains. All nations shall stream to it. That's Christ's kingdom. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God, the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Isaiah 2:2-4. Heart group application this week. This week I want you to ponder the last two e-sites along with this one. What and ask your question as you're pondering is that what is God saying to you this week? Look at part one, which is Jesus' challenge to the kingdoms of this world. And so far, we've looked at two ways in which Jesus' kingdom accomplishes this challenge. We considered in part two how the reign of this little baby lying in a manger frees us from the fear of death or the fear of being penalized, which is the very power of the kingdoms of this world, the power that they use to rule over others. And this week in part three, we looked at how being freed from the fear of death enables us to follow the way of peace or nonviolent non-cooperation like the early church in endeavoring to enlarge Christ's kingdom and to put the world right side up again. And we'll look at more of that in part four, what it really means to put the world right side up. Number two, the heart group application this week, I want you to dedicate a small portion of time each day to pondering these three e-sites, to ponder these themes, and take some time to look up the passages in each one and to think about those as well. And during this time, I want you to also write down or journal the thoughts and the insights that God shares with you as you're contemplating all of this. And number three, I want you to share in this upcoming week what you feel comfortable sharing. I want you to share with your heart group as you guys meet together. According to that little baby lying in a manger, his way of peace implies voluntary submission to the penalty for non-cooperation with the evil we see around us. Luke 9:2 tells us to proclaim, "The King of the earth has come. Now let's go enlarge the kingdom this week, one human heart at a time." Next week, we'll wrap up this four-part series with a look at how the revolution lying in a manger brings restored justice. And nowhere do we see how threatening the Jesus revolution is to those who are being benefited by the systemic injustice of our world more clearly than when we look at the reign of Christ in relation to restorative justice. But we'll get into all that next week. May the truths proclaimed by the events that this season brings to the minds of so many once again be ever present in your heart. Happy holidays to each one of you. I love you guys. I'll see you next week.